coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio. Located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
And welcome to Hagman. It is the Hagman Report for today. It's Monday, August 28th, 2023. I'm glad, folks. Thank you so much for joining me. Thanks for your belief and trust in this platform. In what we do, we really appreciate that. You know, last week was fantastic. We had Michael Yon on Thursday, and he delivered a powerful message about what's really taking place now at the southern border. And boy, have I heard some stuff following that broadcast and naming some NGOs. And don't forget, this Wednesday, we're going to have Attorney Tom Renz on, and he's going to be talking about Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, her troubles and travails, because, well, she's got integrity and the powers don't. Speaking of integrity, I've got with me a man who I look up to. I'll tell you what, he's really a powerhouse in the alternative media. He has sources that most people can only dream of. He has information that most people only wish they had. And with me to share his knowledge, as immense as it is Paul Preston. And if that name rings a bell, Dave Hodges cites Paul quite a bit. Others do as well. He is he's part of Agenda. Well, he is Agenda 21 Radio, agenda21radio.com. That's where you can find out about Paul Preston. And you can is it .news? .news. I apologize. Agenda21radio.news. At any rate, yeah, I can do this. The link will be in the program description box. Just open it up and the link will be right there. And he's on top of just about everything from the fire situation out in California, of course, where he's at in California, or in Hawaii, and then, of course, where he's at in California. The has a lot of knowledge about the Paradise fires as well, but and had something up called the New California Movement, which is really interesting. And I'll tell you something, I learned a lot this weekend by researching that. And we talk about that, the New California Movement, with on our meetings, monthly meetings as well. And many people are following that. So with me, without any further ado, Paul Preston, who, by the way, I'll just mention this. He was listed, and I believe still is, as one of the top 50 most influential alternative media personalities. One of the top 50 at TalkStream Live. Okay, so folks, I'm just so proud to have him with me, Paul Preston. Paul, how are you, sir?
Fine. How are you doing? It's one beautiful day in the neighborhood, like I always tell people.
It depends on which neighborhood you're looking at.
Right, right. Yeah, that's true.
I guess. Yeah, we take a walk down south Chicago. Anyway, Paul, so thankful to have you on. So much to talk about. I don't want to take, you know, your time is valuable. So we had, right before airtime, we talked about the fires in Hawaii. What are we looking at there? I mean, my goodness, one of the worst disasters ever, and they're understating the death toll. You've got sources. I've got sources. I'm hearing all sorts of stuff. What's going on with that?
Well, in my opinion, and we've had experience with a lot of fires out here where I live. I live in Northern California, just a few miles really from Paradise, California. And the infamous Oroville Dam. I covered the Oroville Dam disaster very thoroughly.
That's right.
I was up there. And by the way, the Oroville Dam is just a couple miles from Paradise, literally. And of course, it's kind of like their experimental place. That's what I like to call the globalist out here. Jerry Brown, in particular, the Brown family, very rich history. Even the Pelosi family, very rich history up here. With some of their mafioso ways. But the Paradise situation back in 2018, 5 years ago, was a situation that was really quite abnormal from a fire standpoint. I was sitting in the studio like I am right now at about 5:30 in the morning on the day of the fire, and I get calls from my listeners and some people that are associated with the New California State Movement. In fact, we had just been up there and had a huge, huge turnout for about 400 people in Paradise for a New California State Movement meeting, which we never expected. But boy, these people were really hungry for it. And then now some of them are calling me and saying that they hear that there's a fire. Can I verify that there's a fire? And, you know, I wasn't really thinking. And I thought, well, you guys live in Paradise. You know more than I. If there's a fire, you at least you should. And, of course, there was no notification of any fire to Paradise. The only notification were really some very, very brave sheriffs of Butte County that were running around with their megaphone through the cars telling people to get out, get out, get out, get out, get out. And nobody kind of understood what that signal was all about. And of course, you got a lot of people that were living in the ravines, in the sense that, you know, there's lots of mountainous area, very hard to get to and communicate to. So there was absolutely no warning for any of these people to get out. And for a lot of them, the fire overcame them very quickly. A lot of them did get out on the roads. A lot of them were trapped on the roads, very similar to what you saw, almost identical to what you saw in the situation in Maui. And even as sun rose, the darkness descended because of the fire itself, the smoke. And the smoke was very, very black in color, very similar to what you saw and almost identical to what you saw in Maui. But these people that were calling me, you know, I said to them, well, if there's a fire, you need to get out and get out immediately. And of course, they all got out. Luckily, those people got out, but a lot of other people did not get out. And that was the biggest rub of all. You know, when you take a look at the fire in Paradise, it was like a nuclear bomb went off. And I went up right after the show. I drove up over there, and it was you could see it was a huge conflagration that was going on. The black acrid cloud had come over the whole Central Valley, heading west of all places. Usually the wind comes in from the west. This is now wind that's coming in from the east and blowing everything out to the Central Valley. And it was a blackened cloud, and you drive underneath the cloud because it actually sat up about 1,000 feet above the valley floor. And once you got in underneath it, it was pitch dark. You could see out in front of it on the road, you could see a line of light. But as far as being able to drive on the road correctly, you had to turn your lights on. And when you turn your lights on, it didn't matter. All particulate matter had been sort of evaporated, so light wasn't even refracting off the atmosphere. It was very difficult to see. And so I made my way through at the end of that. And I thought, what the heck kind of fire is this? I'd never seen. I lived in the mountains for about 13 years, at about 7,000 feet. And I've been in a number of forest fires. I'd never seen anything like this before. And so when we finally got up, I had my press credentials. We went up to up on the Skyway, as it's called. And there's a Tuscan golf course up there on the right-hand side. And when I got up there, I noticed that there was a huge camp, and they kept on telling me as I was going up, "There's go to the base camp. We'll meet you at the base camp." And I had no idea what the base camp was. Now, I live up here. You know, I used to live in Magalia, which the house that I lived in burned down, but used to. But I had no idea what they were referring to as a base camp. And so they stop us at the entrance to the Tuscan golf course. Well, the golf course had been taken over by a PG&E camp. It was a huge camp with buildings, trucks, lights, lighted areas, everything. And I thought to myself, what in the world is this? And then I realized that you could see spools of electric cables, you know, the things that go overhead. You could see the telephone poles. You could see all that equipment. You could see transformers. And I thought to myself, why do you have a base camp on this beautiful old golf course, which was completely taken over? And, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, well, this just doesn't jive. So I ended up going up to seeing the fire scene in Paradise, the day of the fires, watching the fire build and things like that. I came down at the end of the day did some reporting outside the airport, the air attack base that have a CAL FIRE has an air attack base there, and was listening to all the operations and stuff. And they weren't putting planes up. That was really kind of weird, except for some of the spotter planes. And then I started to think to myself as I'm going through this, this is really kind of a strange fire, because I would go to that base and other fires at Chico Airport and watch these planes take off. They'd refill with the fire retardant and take off and come back and air operation. And it was a little funny that they weren't doing that. And so that was just the first clue. The other clue was what was going on at the base camp. Well, we then went over to the Walmart in Chico, and that the Walmart was actually starting to service now as a refugee camp for the victims. And so we went over there, and I was just starting the reporting part of it. And I soon realized that there's a disaster going on here, that you have a lot of people, kids in particular, that didn't have parents. And it was a disaster waiting to happen, but there was nothing for them. So the good people of Chico and other parts of the county got together and started, the churches started to get together, clothes and sheltering these people. This is at night now. It's getting very, very cold out. And so I put the call out to the New Californians, our group down in Butte County and the other surrounding counties as far as Sacramento, south of Sacramento. And we instantly mobilized and brought up a whole bunch of stuff, a whole bunch of materials. We started to put the call out, you know, for clothes and food and money. Some of our people met there in their own businesses, donated tens of thousands of dollars for the cards, you know, the credit cards that you could get to go get food and so on, which was very helpful. And we built a camp there and started putting out clothes and shelter and things that we could provide for them, tents if we could get them. And, you know, you had thousands of people literally crammed in a dirt lot trying to survive. And I thought to myself, you know, the state of California is not here. The state of California never showed up to help. They never showed up to help. Neither did FEMA. And finally, it was then the Red Cross showed up, but they were putting everybody off, and everybody was going over to get the stuff from the Red Crosses they said that they would help them with. And then they come back to us and say, the Red Cross isn't doing anything. So it was really a disaster of a monumental proportion. But then we started going up the next day. I went up the second day to examine the burned out area. I actually wanted to check on some houses. I was asked to check on some properties of some people, and they had all got burned down. But then I realized the magnitude of it. It was like a nuclear bomb had gone off, literally. And the temperatures were extremely high. And I could tell that the way the houses were burned and the temperatures had to have been high. I was watching these cars that, you know, the wheels, the rims had been melted. You know, you see the same exact things. Exactly. They look exactly the same as what you're seeing in Maui right now. But there were hundreds of them. Hundreds of these cars, many of them were parked on the side. And that's when I started realizing that there's got to be a high casualty count here. And then I started, you know, talking to sheriffs, and the sheriff was giving me some information, and it was clearly in the thousands, and he couldn't put his fingers on it. It was so big. And the sheriff had ordered up a couple of temporary morgues, military morgues that they would use in combat, ordered two of them up in anticipation of the large numbers of casualties. And then all of a sudden, the numbers started coming in at about 37 dead and 57 dead, and then finally figured out 70-some dead. And it was very, very slow and painful, and we realized that those numbers were completely off. I was talking to people that had been in the fire, that actually sheriff's auxiliary people and other people that were helping at the time were called out from other areas, and they were reporting hundreds of people that they saw were dead or that had died and perished in cars that were parked. And they're now dust. And so there was a couple cars that I had seen with the remains of people. And all you saw was part of the skull. Most of the bones and everything else were ash at the time. So those were kind of like the easy pickings. And the number of dead people that came about in that particular fire, they listed as 87. Now, that meant that they could only find 87 bodies.
Right.
They had thousands that they couldn't account for. And that was about 3,000 is what we figured. And it could have been as high as 5,000. We don't know for sure. I know that we did have an opportunity in the 28 days that we spent up there researching the fires and the high temperatures and everything else that were going on, that they had a mortuary group that was running around, 12 men in a van with white suits on, and they would search properties. And we did have a chance to talk to them, and they said, we can't find the remains of anybody. And they're, you know, people are calling in, my grandfather's missing, can you find him? You know, they developed a list, and I saw the list, and I said, how many people do you think are here? He says, we have at least 3,000 that we can't account for.
My goodness.
So that's where we got that number.
Okay.
And, you know, we were stunned. My team was stunned. We had a couple of people from New California that had backgrounds in biologics and metallurgy and heat. And they were estimating the temperatures at least 3,000 to 4,000 degrees. And of course, that's when we started to put two and two together, that with the aerosol spraying of the chemtrails, you have aluminum oxide. Aluminum oxide is a fire accelerant. I mean, it burns very fast at a very high temperature. But the other insidious thing about it is that we are starting to look at plants that have been growing in the ground. And the plants, the roots had burned in the ground.
Okay.
Now, if you've ever seen that look, it's a very different look. You know, here you have a forest and you have these trees, and you see sometimes oak trees, as an example, that'd be knocked over. And you say, well, that looks kind of strange. It's a perfectly good looking, healthy oak tree, and it's knocked over and it isn't burned. But when you look down and you look at, there's a big hole, that's where the rootstock was. And the tree just tipped over because the rootstock had been burned inside the soil. And so that's when we said to ourselves, you know, something really hot burned that. And it had to be 3,000 to 4,000 degrees. That's what was the conclusion of our people were saying. And so then we started doing some real thinking that, well, obviously the aluminum oxide is bonding with iron in the soil. Mm. Well, of course it is. The soil is all red, just like in Maui, the soil is red. So it was combining with it. When it does that, it makes a compound called thermite.
Right.
And thermite will burn at 3,000 to 4,000 degrees. And that's how we got the high temperatures on those plants. The microwaving effect of the houses by way of the smart meter and by way of whatever signal they were giving off for microwaves was the trigger for the houses to burn at such a high temperature as well. And that's why all the homes turned to white ash. Everything was white ash. The walls collapsed in, the ceiling. There weren't, you know, normally in a forest fire, and I've seen this many times in fires over my life, but when you have a house that burns, you know, there's usually parts of the house that are remaining.
Right.
You know, you can see a wall or the roof or collapse in or something, but not in these fires. You know, there's nothing. And you see that in Maui, same thing.
Yeah, I was just going to say the appearance from Paradise, the pictures I've seen, after the tragedy, or after the fires, from Paradise, look very similar to Maui or vice versa. And you know, I remember one case. I worked one case of an automobile fire, and this was a hot fire. And there was a man that was insured for, I think it was $2.5 million in this vehicle. And it was the whole thing was strange. But the fact is, it didn't look anything like what I saw in Maui with the pictures from Maui or with the Paradise fire. So, yeah. So, okay. So you're saying obviously that there's something here pretty foul going on.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, so we spent 28 days. We worked with, we worked with the Epoch Times and some other agencies and reporting and that sort of thing. And they provided great services for us and stuff. And we reached some very interesting conclusions that we noticed that homes that didn't have their electricity on survived. Homes that had their electricity on with an analog meter survived. We're talking about an electric meter. And with the smart meters, if the power was off, they survived. If the power was on, it's obvious that the entrance into the house wiring system was through that smart meter, because all the smart meters literally had blown up. The wires had melted, and the house had been incinerated from the inside out. When you have a house that's incinerated from the inside out, the walls and everything collapse in. And you'll notice that in a lot of these fires that you can have plastic tubs right outside next to the house.
Yep.
And they survive, right? They survive, yeah. But you look at the house and it's gone. It's just all ash, white ash. That's the reason why, is that they use the wiring inside the house to incinerate it like a microwave. It gets to extremely high temperatures, around 3,000 degrees, and that's what causes the white ash.
My goodness. Okay. And I think, would you say that, like Paradise, Maui, multiple sources of ignition, whether it be, the initial start of the fires, whatever that might have been, along with the another point of origin would be by way of the smart meters, perhaps something, multiple points, modes of origin. Would that be an accurate statement?
Yeah. Okay. But they're all manufactured. This isn't an arsonist walking around with a bag of, sparklers.
No, not at all.
This is an airplane, or these are aircraft aloft that are shining beams down. And there's a lot of beams that were reported by people. That was one of the first things I heard about on my telephone call in the early morning. I was getting ready for my show, just like you're getting ready for your show. And all of a sudden you're being hit with, I got to get out of my house. There's these beams, I'm like, what's that? Well, I learned later, cause actually some of our local TV stations have reported some of them and showed a couple of them. And I said, oh, that's a direct energy weapon. And I was familiar with those from Raytheon and, Grumman and those companies. They make them. And they've made them for the U.S. military, and they do have projects that have been going on. I understood that there were some projects that have been going on for a long time with that. And I said to myself, they're using these on Americans. So that was another hard conclusion. I had to kind of walk myself through it. But that was a conclusion that now we can kind of really understand. And I think what I think has happened in Maui, it's fast forward 5 years, there's a couple things. We were the only independent news group up there, citizen journalists. There were some that were starting to come around. Deborah Tavares, as an example, did a fantastic job in her reportage of furthering where we had left off in a number of things. And one of the people that was there was contributing was a former fire captain who actually was part of New California at the time. He's since passed on. But he was very, very helpful in getting us to understand, I think, Deborah Tavares and the other people to understand that these fires are really caused by outside agents, and it's not a natural fire. In fact, all of the fires in California, when we look back on it, were not natural. Many of them had been caused by the same types of sources as we started to find out. We found out that really what Jerry Brown was doing was helping CAL FIRE and working in conjunction with CAL FIRE. And yes, I am accusing them of this. CAL FIRE, which, by the way, is now assigned to FEMA, and guess where they are? They're over there in Maui spending $1,500 to $4,000 a night for a room in Maui to stay on FEMA's dime,
right,
just to let you know. But CAL FIRE was very intimate, involved with Jerry Brown in starting these fires, and for capitalistic reasons, we called it disaster capitalism, because the federal government will backfill and will actually pay a profit to these, what amounts to a profit to the state, of billions of dollars. And of course, Jerry Brown needed those billions of dollars to keep the state solvent. And we quickly started to look into that one as a real reason for these crimes. One day alone, I was actually doing a follow-up coverage on the Oroville Dam. So I go up to the top of the tower of the Oroville Dam lookout area, and I'm ready to do my stick and talking to the report on what's going on for Agenda 21 Radio. And I look in the stick, and I said, my God, that looks like a plume of smoke. And I turned around, and a fire had started. Just within minutes, a fire had started. It was called what is known as the Chinese Wall of Fire. And it was one of 27 fires that started at the same time that day in California.
Wow.
Now, there's something wrong with that picture, isn't there?
Yeah. Please go on. I mean, okay.
This is the kind of. Well, it's the only way to explain it is that, you know, they were trying to explain it that it was arsonist. Napa and Sonoma fires in particular, they were saying that those were arson. As we looked at it, it wasn't arson at all, because guess what? You had the same kind of homes looking like the same kind of thing as you had in all the other areas. Santa Maria was the same. They had a huge fire up there. Santa Rosa, excuse me. They had a huge fire up there. I was going to do a speaking engagement in Santa Rosa. And I was driving. I'm a biologist, so, you know, kind of let you know, botany is one of my big things, genetics and virology and botany. I love it. But I was driving around, and I noticed the desiccation of the trees. Trees desiccate when they get filled with compounds that are poisonous to them. And aluminum oxide is very detrimental to a tree. It causes, rather than a tree that's brilliantly green, deep green, to be sort of a greenish brown color, and if it's a broad leaf, it kind of curls in on the leaves. So I was noticing in that area they have a lot of different types of plants, but most of them were desiccated. And so I pulled over at one point in time, and just to check out the plants. I'm doing like a doctor, which I'm checking out these plant leaves, and I'm saying these things are totally desiccated. You know, I didn't realize how bad they had been chemtrailed. And so it was just a couple of days after that they had their big fire, and I said, voila, here it is. Because the fire, you know, once it got into the plant tissue, then it hit a flash point, and it would burn very, very hot, probably 3,000 degrees, 3,000 to 4,000 degrees. That's that high temperature we talk about.
Right.
So they're just torches waiting to go off at a very high temperature. Plus, you have buildings that are saturated with aluminum oxide. It makes like a soup, and pretty soon things are really getting out of control. Spontaneous explosions of cars and things like that because of the high heat. You really saw some pretty good pictures at the time. You can go back and take a look at what was going on in Paradise. It was the same, but in Maui, there was some pretty graphic stuff that showed, excuse me, people driving in their cars, and the car inside of it is very, very hot. Right. In fact, as people were telling me when they were driving it to escape it, if they touched the side of the door or the window, it would burn them, literally burn them. People couldn't put their feet on the floorboard because it was so hot. And they were very fortunate to get out. Many people, of course, didn't. But you saw some pretty graphic stuff going on in Maui, which is very emblematic of what is going on, what went on in Santa Rosa, what went on in Napa and Sonoma, all that whole area, because there were people trapped in those cars, too. The first time I heard about this, a fire captain who used to be with us, a different fire captain, had the radio on in the background. I was asking him about the fire. It was the middle of the night, and I could hear them talking about in the background, the fireman. He was in the station in the background about these people in their car being incinerated in their cars. And I thought to myself, geez, you know, these are Americans doing this to Americans. And that's what happened in Maui. But you know, now we're finding out a little bit more because it truly is, as I was saying, because I've been doing Agenda 21 Radio now since, you know, 2010. This is a globalist adventure, basically, to get us out of different places on the planet and to destroy us. And again, this is a property grab going on. You know, so you can have your big 15-minute city or smart city in Maui.
Yeah.
And it's pretty obvious that that's what's going on. And people like over at Winfrey support that. And what about Bezos? He comes in, I'm going to throw $100 million at this and help everybody out. Well, most of the people, you know, we're looking at over 2,000 kids incinerated. I mean, I'm a former school superintendent. When they came out on Friday with their report for the Hawaii schools, and I knew exactly what they were doing. I knew I could have told my number was at least 2,000 at the time for the kids, and they came out with 2,025 are missing.
Wow!
I mean, I knew what their numbers were. I could know the size of the schools, and I can project it. You know, that was my business for a long time, and so here we are. Now Maui's missing 2,025 kids. And some people are making excuses, well, the kids have gone to other places. No, they haven't. They haven't been able to track where the kids have gone. What happens when a kid goes to another school, the school that receives a kid puts in an immediate request for the records.
Right.
They haven't had any records requests received.
Wow.
That's called a clue.
Yeah, yeah.
That's called a clue.
But it's difficult to get Americans to, well, most people to really pay attention to this and to understand the magnitude of what is taking place. Folks, my guest, and I'm so pleased to have him, Paul Preston, Agenda21Radio.News, HagmanPI.com. Open up the description box for today. Click on that link. Make sure you bookmark that. And also, please listen to his broadcast, podcast, everything there. You can get to everywhere you need to go from Agenda21Radio.News. Paul Preston is, again, my guest. And I'm so thankful to have him. So the Americans are not being told the truth about any of this. And people like yourself who are telling the truth are being censored, obviously. But what's the bottom line here? What's next? I mean, what area is next? I don't even want to go there. Go ahead. Go ahead.
This is war. Like it or not, this is war. They declared war on us. We didn't declare war on them.
Yep.
That's just it. This is war on us. And these are the globalists. These are the elites. These are the oligarchs. A couple of examples of oligarchs that have been a problem. Oprah Winfrey, she goes to Maui. See, the people in Maui are fierce people, all native locals, as they call themselves, are fierce warriors. And there are a warrior culture and breed, and they will not take crap. They really won't. They won't take an Oprah Winfrey BS or a Bezos or a Zuckerberg. When it comes down to these kind of issues, these are blood issues. And you can see that when you listen to the people talk in Maui, and even the Hollies, as they call them, an American white-skinned guy, Hollie, has some of that rubbed off on him. I did an interview, a couple of interviews with some of the Americans that are over there, and they've got that same attitude. They're not going to take it. They get what has happened. And they're not going to take it. And I really predict that there's going to be some very serious pushback. It's already started on the governor. It's starting on that police chief that's there, on the mayor, and especially the mayor, but the governor in particular, whose last name is Green. Figure.
Josh Green. Yep.
Right. And he's got a past being involved with the globalist. Josh Green is... he was speaking before the United Nations about 15-minute cities, but a couple of weeks before this incident.
Yep.
They enacted laws and policies, some of it policies that were developed by bureaucrats and nobody elected officials, which they need to look into. That's classic situation we deal with in California, because we're a dictatorship and that's the way dictators operate. Policies that will enhance the purchase of the properties. They've got this whole thing going on that he's going to be able to declare this, quote, a natural disaster. This is not a natural disaster.
No,
this is not it's anything but natural. And everything points to it as man-made. Now, this is going to be a problem because they're going to challenge the government on this. And I think the citizens are going to prevail one way or another. They're going to prevail. They're not going to let this go. These people in Maui, all throughout the islands, they're going to rise up against this. And this is going to put a stop to it. And I think the embarrassment that's being dished out to people like Oprah Winfrey, shame on her. Shame on her to, under the pretense of coming to help these people, bring her old camera crews out there with her. The people shut her out. You know that, don't you? They wouldn't let her come in any of the shelters or anything like that. They kicked her out. They effectively kicked her out, which is good. She needs to be kicked out. She needs to be kicked to the curb. Don't get me started. this is pure evil. I mean, one of the things I went up Saturday to Paradise. It's the first time I've been up in about a year or so. I've been watching the comeback of Paradise and stuff, and I visited many of the places that we did a lot of research on, many of the homes that and play locations for the homes that were people that had been burned out or friends had been burned out. And, you know, it just really hit me hard that this is real warfare. Real people died here. I could look at the landscape now as the, some of the green stuff has started to come back. But to remember those days that when it looked like a nuclear bomb had gone off and people had been vaporized right at my feet, it really is an indelible impression. And that's what they're dealing with right now in Maui. And I think there's some people that have a problem with that in Maui. I hope they're very disturbed by it, the people that have been benefiting by it. You know, the police chief. This guy turns out to be the incident commander in the Mandalay Bay disaster, which, by the way, I thought maybe he'd be interested in solving the crime. We still don't know to the day, to this day, what happened in Mandalay Bay. And, you know, I always said of him at the time, he's a major obstacle in finding out what really happened. Well, now he shows up here in Maui, but comes in two years ago. He gets paid, you know, $200,000. They give him a big boost and a big, after about 60 days in office, they give him a, I don't know, $50,000 pay raise or something, like something stupid. And now here he is as the incident commander of Maui.
Yes.
Now, what's he trying to do? He's going to assuage everybody. I don't think so. This guy is now also the coroner.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. He also happens to be the coroner, but I guess that's by state statute, maybe. I'm not sure, but he's a coroner, too.
He's the coroner, too. You know, and usually, see, they don't have sheriffs like we have traditional sheriffs, because sheriffs and coroners can be in the same office. They can do the same thing. Yeah, but he does not. This is a new thing for him. I did some research and I found he's never done this before. He's never had cadaver work or done anything around cadavers or dead. I mean, he's seen dead people and stuff, and I'm sure he's had an experience in the policing world. But, you know, I was watching him in the press conference, and he was deeply disturbed personally at a personal level. He had figured it out. These people had been vaporized. Mm-hmm. And that's when they shut everything down. They didn't want people wandering through the homes, through the buildings, because quite frankly, when you do look for bodies in this environment, there is a special characteristic that you might be able to see in the dust in certain parts of the home to see if you can find bodies.
Yeah.
As it was explained to me by the people that were showing up and checking for the bodies in Paradise. But you know, the realization that there were bodies in the home, and the last time they saw people were in their homes, and now all you see is dust. To walk it through the homes, it desecrates the ground. And I think that bothered him, that there are thousands of people still unaccounted for in Maui, and we couldn't have people just traipsing through this facility. I understand that. I totally understand why he would do that. But I think that really hit him hard and disturbed him.
Do you think... And this isn't entirely, I know this is speculative, but do you think that he had any kind of advanced knowledge of this? I mean,
I think they all did.
That, yeah. Okay.
Listen, I'm done with these people. They all know what's going on.
Yeah, I agree.
They all know that this is their technique now. And they think that we're not smart enough to figure it out.
Yeah.
This is the thing that, you know, I made this point earlier. I was like one of the only citizen journalists up there reporting for Paradise and using my platform, Agenda 21 Radio. I was one of the only ones.
Yep.
And now you have a phalanx of citizen journalists in Maui. Oh, God. Now that all of a sudden they're getting exposed and they're hounding these leaders and they can't stand it. You know, these leaders have had everything controlled. We got the controlled press conference. We got this. We got that. And that's, of course, the way they do it out here in California. Forget about the public. We can't have the public around. We'll sit. You know, Gavin Newsom doesn't have press conferences. What Gavin Newsom has is a sterilized room. He's got one of his staff members who relays questions that come in on the phone from hand-picked and selected reporters. They're going to ask him easy softball questions. That's the way he does it. And that's the way all of them want to do it. They don't want anything to do with the public in their face. Or you go down to the legislature in California, it's the same way. The legislature doesn't want to deal with the public. No one wants to deal with it. See, that's the whole – this is part of the Agenda 21 radio – Agenda 21 takeover, Agenda 2030, I guess you could say, takeover of the governmental agencies and leaders in the – basically, the next step they'll try and do, and you're starting to hear this actually, is to do away with elections so you don't have elected officials. It's just the straight bureaucrats making the decisions.
Oh, yeah.
That'll be the next step.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I've been watching that slowly being introduced. You can see it on social media, whatever platform you're on, about the really we don't need elections. Forecasting the will of the people. I mean, it's insane what's going on. So, okay. But the blowback, you mentioned something I think is really important. I think that the people behind this agenda in Maui specifically have grossly underestimated the what they're up against with the citizens, the native citizens of Maui there. I really think that there's going to be some pretty interesting times there. Coming.
I do too. I think that the history of Hawaii is wonderful, actually, and I have friends who live over there and friends who go and spend several months at a time during the year. But these are fierce warrior people, and they've been played by the worst. First the Japanese, then to them the Americans. There's a competition, where Hawaii is. You've had a lot of Polynesians. It's a melting pot for various cultures and societies. And, now you have the Chinese and their influence. And they've always been there, but it's just now it's even worse. Like in California, we're just overrun in our whole culture with the Chinese in terms of their influences all over the place. And we're talking about the CCP Chinese, by the way.
Right.
They're the ones that are the problem. And we can see that quite clearly out here in California. And they work with all the elected officials, which is a problem for those elected officials, right? Well, they don't seem to think so. They take the money and they're fine. But what happened in Hawaii, and this is the thing this is all leading to, I think, is that Hawaii was a warrior. Well, each island was its own empires, and then all of a sudden they came under one empire under King Kamehameha, basically. And King Kamehameha went into agreements with the Americans in 1830s. And by 1839, they came up with a constitution that was written in the reflection of the U.S. Constitution of 1787. And it's interesting to note, he was still King Kamehameha with that constitution, and that constitution went into play even up to statehood. The thing that's interesting to really note is that there was no Declaration of Independence by Hawaii or King Kamehameha. And the reason for that is very obvious, that there was no need for a Declaration of Independence because it stayed a monarchy. They just needed the guidance of the Constitution to be written, and they got it. And so then they had this issue that blew up, and this is their narrative now. That's coming from, and this is the precautionary thing I tell everybody at this point. There was this 1893 business in which they said that there was a complete takeover of the Hawaiian Islands by the Americans. And as a result, the Americans had no territorial connections. They should never have made Hawaii a state. That's really kind of a bogus argument. Yeah, because, you have to go back to really the original nature of that Constitution and before that and understand that there never was a Declaration of Independence. There could have been. They could have claimed their Declaration of Independence against the United States as a colonizer or Great Britain as a colonizer. And they didn't do that. They wanted to keep the monarchy and government, which was good. Then they wanted to make a transition starting around 1840s. They wanted to be 1940s. They wanted to become a state, and statehood started to erupt. By 1959, they became a state. Now, that's the last state in the Union so far. It's the 50th state.
Right.
New California is the 51st state. We're going to be going on to Congress. Well, we're on to Congress. We've actually submitted our paperwork, and we're going to become the 51st state. So,
and folks, if you haven't heard, and I can't believe this audience, I'm sure we have new people tuning in all the time. New California, what's that? New California state. Tell people about this, because this to me, and I did my homework over the weekend in advance in preparation for today's show. And I'm absolutely fascinated by the structure and about your Paul Preston, about his knowledge, constitutional knowledge, the workings, you know, Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, how things work. Look at West Virginia, for example. So I'm really impressed by this. This is not some pie-in-the-sky dream.
Right.
You know, so go ahead. Tell people about that.
Well, I recognized through what I was seeing in the schools at California was slipping into communism. And I had worked with Janet Evans, the Olympic swimmer from 1987 to about 93, in a very unique situation as a school administrator and so on. And I watched her compete against the East Germans in 1988 Olympics and crush them. Also was taking the blowback as a school administrator when she returned home from Seoul, Korea. And we put her in a classroom, Jim Dispenet, who was an English teacher, first period. And we set up a CNN camera outside the outside door, and he was able to peer in. They watched her come in. And that was a big thing for the nation. It was a big thing for the world when that whole thing happened. And about 8:30 in the morning, I get a call from an East German fellow who had been calling me incessantly, berating Janet. I mean, it was a propaganda call is what it was. And I kind of listened in on it just because it was kind of unique that you were getting this call from him. To me, it was an East German call, and, you know, worldwide things happening. It was kind of exciting. And so I kind of had a little bit of a relationship with him. But in mid-sentence, he just started to cry. And cry. Sounded like some big, burly, you know, bad guy. And all of a sudden, he just starts crying. And he says, my dream of communism is dead. I asked him, I said, why are you crying? He says, my dream of communism is dead. And it just hit me, you know, how do you have a dream of communism when we live in liberty? We're living the dream. You know, and man, I sat there and I thought, geez, this is affecting people. I mean, really, you're just doing your job. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, you're really affecting people here.
Yes.
People around the world are looking at this. So, and then, of course, that was in September of 1988. And then by November of 1989, the wall came down. Now, we knew what was going on between those two times, and we knew we had some sort of an impact. And so it was very curious to me. So when Janet was performing in Barcelona, I went to the Olympics in Barcelona. But in the meantime, I spent a couple months in East Germany trying to track down information about the collapse of communism. Mm-hmm. And I ended up at the Church of St. Nikolai with the help of a Wall Street Journal reporter by the name of Roger Thoreau, and interviewed a guy by the name of Friedrich Mercurius, who was one of the guys responsible for the Monday Masses in Leipzig, Germany. And he gave me a lot of pointers, a lot of information about what happened in the collapse of communism. And it was very interesting. But when I left the interview, it took about 3 hours. We spent three hours together. It was delightful. And I didn't ask him the question that everybody on the West wanted to know about. And that was, you know, when communism collapsed, where did all the communists go, right? I mean, one day you're a communist, the next day you're not.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, yeah. You know, and so I was literally standing in the doorway at the end of the conversation. I said, Friedrich, I said, you know, I got to ask you this question. I said, when communism collapsed, where did all the communists go? And he looked at me straight like, you know, come on, you don't know? And I said, no. Where'd they go? He said, all became environmentalists.
There you go, folks. That
they all became environmental. That just sends it right through the roof. So anyway, that was I found out a lot. I learned a lot. He tipped me off to go to Berlin, back into Berlin, and visit the remains of the Führer bunker. And so I did, and I ran into a guy by the name of Christoph Neubauer. And Christoph Neubauer has since become famous because he was in the History Channel's Hunting Hitler.
Oh, yeah.
And okay. I spent numerous hours with Christoph Neubauer, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the collapse of the Third Reich and the rise of the Fourth Reich. And then I also learned a lot about the collapse of communism and the rise of communism at home. And I knew then what the plan was for America back in 1992, and I could see it through the schools as plain as day, California schools in particular. And so that's when my quest really started at that point in time, after 1992, that there's got to be a way to stop all this. And ultimately what it came down to was researching how can we stop the insults against our Constitution, because that's really what it was. And then finding out the history of the Constitution, where it came from, the founding fathers. E. Morrison, I had really good professors in college, for a constitutionalist professors who were really, really solid. And that was really a big help. I could harken back to those days. I used to even have my old college papers and stuff like that. And I would go back and look at them, and I said to myself, you know, the founding fathers had this totalitarian thing already figured out, you know, and it's already contained in the documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. And that's what really started me going on this whole constitutional thing. And I said to myself about mid-2000 or so, 2004 and 5, I said, there's got to be a constitutional answer to stop it cold. And that's when I looked at Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution. It said, if you want to form a state from a pre-existing state, then you have to get the permission of the state concerned and then that of the Congress. And I said to myself, there may be something to this. And so by 2010, I was starting to interview people on my radio show that I had started, called the Inside Education Show. And as I interviewed them, I started to get more details. And then I ended up in the Jefferson Movement. And that taught me a lot about Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, and about how to do the state splits and things like that. The Jefferson Group, I left because they wanted to go to the courts and figure it out. But it's very clear, it says in the Constitution, that if you want to form a state from a pre-existing state, you have to use the legislature. You can't use the executive branch by having votes, and you can't use the judicial branch by having a decision by a judge. A judge cannot form a state. It's just like, you know, a judge cannot rule on election law. It's very difficult for them because, you know, they're a different branch of government, and they're excluded. The Constitution is very clear that the legislatures are the ones that control voting and elections.
Correct.
And so that's why you have judges that are really hesitant, and that you certainly don't want the executive branch. But that's what happened with Newsom. Newsom on his own, during the COVID, declared executive privilege, and he ordered 123 million mail-in ballots. But here's the thing. All those ballots were labeled incorrectly, should never have been voted on. They were moot, actually, but they were counted. And of course, the rest is history at this point. That's another story. We actually sued him on behalf of New California for that, but that's another story. But getting back into how we ended up with New California, we went through this process to form a state. We looked back at the Constitution. We looked back at history. We looked at the West Virginia, how they formed a new state, because they were really the last one to form a state using this process. And so we discovered a lot of things along the way. So we got ourselves organized, very similar to what West Virginia did. We went around and got counties to become part of it. We chartered counties. We got leadership in counties. And then pretty soon everybody's thinking, you know, this constitutional thing is pretty interesting. It's actually working. And, you know, we discovered that, you know, you can make it work if you just follow the rules. And you realize that your inspiration, the authority that gives us the authority to do this, is the Declaration of Independence. Read it, because it tells you that if, you know, there's a tyrant, you got to get rid of the tyrant. It says you have a right and a duty to throw off the tyrant. And we were living with Jerry Brown at that point in time. And clearly, California had flipped to a communist state. And it did so starting after 1996. And this is the key thing, that communism has flourished here in this state for a long time. They've been around for a long time. It is clearly a totalitarian state, and it's getting worse and worse every single day, to the point where now everything they do is illegal for the most part. Or they feel that they can do anything they want with impunity, and it's violating a lot of people's rights, as you know. And of course, California is just a mess, but that's another part of what we're doing. So we ended up putting together our first constitutional convention. But even before that, we said, how do you tell the state that you're out? And what you do is you form a Declaration of Independence. So the very first thing we did when we got a lot of our counties together, we set a point and said, if we have 18 counties of the 58, we'll declare independence. And that happened in October of 2017. And by January 15, 2018, we declared independence from the state of California. And we laid down the reasons why, that he's a tyrant, that we live in a tyranny, very similar to what they said in the Declaration of Independence. In fact, the research that we did on the Declaration of Independence led us to the fact that we probably better copy much of what's in the Declaration of Independence, the original Declaration of Independence, hijack it, and use it for ourselves. And I'd suggest anybody do that, actually.
Okay, but that doesn't automatically make a state, right? I mean,
no.
Folks, go to agenda21radio.news and click on the link that says New California and take a look at the map. You made that declaration. Go ahead. Continue.
Well, we made the declaration, and then we read grievances, and we changed it up because from the original Declaration of Independence, they put 27 grievances in the declaration. They amended them. And we chose a different route. We decided that what we're going to do is read grievances, 95 grievances into the records for 95 weeks. Every week on Tuesday at 11 o'clock, we would read a grievance from a superior court building in California. We encourage all of our counties to do that. At one time, we had 40 counties actually reading all at one time. Imagine on a Tuesday, you'd go to any superior court building and you'd see people from New California reading these grievances. And that was actually happening. And so we've read our first 95, and then we decided we're going to read another 95. We recognized that we weren't done with the grievances. There were so many. But it's also in our process. We were processing. And I told people, I said, making a state is not an event. And a lot of people treat it like it's an event. When you talk to them, say, oh, yeah, well, you can't do that. How do you know you can't do that? Well, I just know you can't because, you told me so. And I said, well, if you look at it as an event and not a process, you're probably right. But this is a process, an ongoing process to become a state. It's not an exercise in one day. We're just going to have a jump ball and play a basketball game. And right. It doesn't work that way. The game is day to day to day and month to month to month and year to year to year, and process and events and achieving things. And, of course, one of the first things we had to achieve was a Declaration of Independence, and we achieved that. And then we started reading the grievances, and we achieved that. So we started to build towards a constitutional convention. So by, I think it was July of 2018, we had our very first constitutional convention, which meant, we're going to now make the Constitution. And so now we're building a constitution through process and meetings and having conventions. And we did that. And then, of course, the first constitutional convention, we realized that we could start our own government, which we did. We started a bicameral legislature with an assembly and also with a Senate. And we had an established executive branch. We hadn't started our judicial yet. That was only the second part of it. So by the first constitutional convention, we had established an executive branch and a legislature. We were looking for the judicial and we had attorneys helping us, but that wasn't quite the judicial branch we were looking for. And then later, by the second or third convention, we had again passed more resolutions. We passed three resolutions in the first assembly or the first convention. One of them was to accept the Declaration of Independence. We voted on that. In other words, that's our document by which we have authorities to act, which is, this is all constitutional now. We're not, this is not just, you know, placating legal systems or whatever. This is a constitutional legal effort.
Well, this is mirroring what West Virginia did with it back in 1861. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, 1861.
All right.
And so then the next thing we did is we adopted a preamble, resolution for a preamble. And the third thing, what's most important, is we put God in the preamble. We worded it so it would reflect the divine hand of God. And every preamble of every state, all 50 states, have the same sort of language about God. And again, this sort of explodes the whole imagination of the leftists out there. But our founding fathers were very religious people, and they believed in God, and this was, you know, a godly country. Shocking, as I know, to some people, that we've just pushed that whole thing aside. But God plays a big role in what we're doing. We understand that in New California. We accept that. We accept the responsibility for that, and we hold it proudly. We're not ashamed that we're godly people.
Amen.
And the founding fathers never were, and we aren't either. And, you know, we stand up and represent that. We're proud to do that. And so, but by the, we had a second constitutional convention, a third one, and a fourth one. And so we're all along building more and more legislation, and we're building a credibility with our own legal actions, what we're doing, because by this point in time, we had gotten a judiciary set up, and we did have a very, very powerful attorney in Robert Thomas, who was a former prosecutor from Orange County and also from Butte County, former Marine. He also is qualified to practice law before the Supreme Court. Mm. And so when the election came in 2020, we actually were part of the protestation of what happened in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. And we joined up with the state of Texas as an amicus. And our amicus was accepted by the Supreme Court. First time in a new budding state in development has ever had any document accepted by the Supreme Court. First time in American history. We're wow. very proud of that. And we met everything that's in the amicus. It's a matter of record. You can read it. It's very thorough. We stuck to it because, see, we, by that point in time, we understood what the voting fraud was all about. And we had actually experienced the voting fraud. We saw what happened with the COVID as the cover. We knew that that was happening. The California legislature rolled over and gave executive power, their power, to the executive branch, which neutered them. So Gavin Newsom was a dictator, literally a dictator. So he immediately orders up the 120 million, 123 million ballots, which is unconstitutional. He gets sued. And as it turns out, the Superior Court agrees with the plaintiffs and says that he acted as a dictator and he should never have ordered the ballots. The decision wasn't rendered until the day before the election.
Okay.
And so they have the election. But we look at the ballots and we determine there's something really wrong with the ballots. And the ballots didn't have the right language on them for a presidential election, which meant that by election code, that none of the ballots that had that language on them could be cast or counted. And as it turns out, in our lawsuit, we pointed out that all 58 counties of California had some language problem, which meant that all 58 ballots in California could not be cast or counted. So we sued on that. And as it turned out, the court wouldn't let us go through. Now, another key thing happened. We started our hearings as a legislature in Shasta County. And Shasta County was great. We've always had a really strong support base up in Shasta County. And so our very first field hearing we conducted on December 3rd, 2020 in Shasta County, and it was about elections. And I'll tell you, we gained so much information on that first day. That's when I got on the phone to our attorney, Robert. I said, we got to do something about this. And so, I mean, because we had it all, it was all explained to us. We already had a pretty good idea of what was going on. But then to bring in witnesses, people who actually voted, then you had some businesses, and then we had some other things out. So we got so much information on that third that we came back the fifth and had a second hearing within 2 days and got more information. And so now we're loaded for bear. That's when we filed suit, was after that. So, you know, Shasta County has been ahead of the game in terms of information. As you know, Shasta County, much help with New California and some other people. Yep. The Patriots in particular of Shasta County, hats off and salute to them. They've done a fantastic job. They've stepped up. There's so many things going on, the good dynamics with the people up there. But New California provided a lot of legal guidance for the things that have happened up there and a lot of other advice to make things happen. And what happened was, of course, they threw out the Dominion machines, which we couldn't be more delighted than that, that they actually did throw those out as voting devices. And now they're looking into paper ballots, which is what we're doing in all of New California. That's a whole different effort. But my point is that we use that to sue Gavin Newsom, Shirley Weber, and Alex Padilla. And then in the meantime, what we got was a lot of discovery. And we found out that the certificate of certification of the 2020 election and the transfer and the certification of the 55 electoral votes, Alex Padilla, who was the Secretary of State, never signed it.
Right. Yeah.
There's a problem there. And we've concluded that Alex Padilla didn't sign it because he didn't want to perjure himself.
Exactly.
He did not want to perjure him. And then it was Shirley Weber on April 7th, the replacement for him, on April, because remember, he went off and took Kamala Harris's position as yep. senator. And Shirley Weber on April 7th signs the certification. April 7th.
April 7th.
And none of that should have been allowed in. And of course, if Pence had awakened, and well, he was all part of the problem, in my opinion. Absolutely, the problem.
Yep.
And everything Trump said about him and everybody else has said about him is absolutely true. He had every right as the vice president to say, okay, let's put a pause on this. And the pressure was coming from everywhere. And the people, I mean, you had 123 legislators, senators, and members of the House saying, stop, there's something wrong. Yep. And let's put a 10-day pause on this. Plus, you also had the certification of Donald Trump, who came in because of the other law, which is the continuity of government law, which is the Economic Emergency Powers Act. They had certifiable evidence that the Chinese were directly involved with interfering with our election. He gave that to Nancy Pelosi. It is in the December 5th, a congressional record. You can read it. It's in the upper right-hand corner. Donald Trump did exactly what he was supposed to do, yet they ignored it and they blew it off. And Pence knew about this. He knew all about this. But in the meantime, with our lawsuit, they never let us have any shortened time period in which we could protest and become part of that group. The court slow walked that they even admitted they were not going to hear the case. This is like in July of 2021, they admitted it.
So we have no system of justice. We've got no working systems at all, basically, right now. So where does that leave us? Yeah, your lawsuit, the process of New California. Where does all of this stand?
Well, let me be clear about a couple things. That in the process of forming a state, the executive branch has nothing to do with it. They're irrelevant. The executive branch, the governor, the state, or the president.
Right. The state and the federal. Go ahead.
Either one, the executive and even the judiciary, they have nothing to do with it. They can't interfere. And so this is a one-on-one with the legislatures. And then, of course, the state legislature, California state legislature, get their permission. That's the idea. And then move on to Congress. And the Congress is the one that actually authorizes to vote to give you the compact that you're seeking to become a state. But on the, in our situation, we had a little hitch in the giddy up. We looked at the West Virginia model and we learned that in the West Virginia model, they had a hitch in the giddy up too, in that they were about to go to war when all this state was forming, when they were trying to get the state off the ground. It's called the Civil War. And they were realizing that they did not want to go and become part of the Confederacy as a slave state. They'd had enough of the slavery thing, even though they had slaves there. I know the tradition and history, right. But they wanted to extract themselves. The people did. And so they did not want to go along with anything that would look like the Confederacy. So the people in Virginia, the government of Virginia at the time, knew that. And so they went to convention. They agreed that they wanted to go to the Confederacy. They marked a date on the calendar in which they'd vote whether to go to the Confederacy or not. They interrupted that, and they just decided they're going to go to the Confederacy. Well, that left the West Virginians saying, wait a minute, we want to apply to become a state with you guys, and now you're gone. What do we do? So they went off to the Congress and said, I guess we just have to apply to you, Congress. And Congress said, no, you have to satisfy Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, get the state's concerns permission, and then move on to Congress. Well, the state's concern just left. It left them high and dry. And so they came back. Francis Pierpont, you can read the history about this. It's very fascinating. He was an attorney. He said, well, if they're gone, we as West Virginians, we are still Virginians. We haven't become a state yet. We will form a reorganized government of Virginia.
Mm.
So what they did is that they formed a reorganized government of Virginia. They got a governor. They got a lieutenant governor. They got a legislature, you know, that was there, the House of Representatives. They got all these people selected. And they said, okay, now what we're going to do is you West Virginians, you write up a resolution, give it to us as the restored government of Virginia, and we'll approve it. And they did. And they went off to Congress. And the Congress said, oh, wait a minute here. You know, they kind of balked. They turned to Abraham Lincoln for help. And Lincoln talked to Congress. And sure enough, they let him in. And they not only that, they became a state 2 years later. So when the government leaves the people in a situation like this, what do? The answer is you reorganize your own government because you're still citizens of that state, and you do what you need to do. Well, that's what's happened in California. California is a communist, Nazi, fascist state in that order. And there's no making, listen, there's no excuses. That's exactly what it is.
Right.
People of America need to understand this. This is communism. And it's only getting worse. And when it gets worse and they come for the guns, which, by the way, just the last couple of days, you've been hearing the drumbeat already from the Attorney General of California, Rob Bonta, they're going to come for our guns. Well, guess what? We're not going to let that happen. But my point is that they have left us high and dry. How can we want to form a Republican form of government. We want freedom from invasion. We want freedom from domestic violence, which is Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, that they have to provide to us, and they're not doing that.
Right.
They are formed a communist organization. It's a dictatorship. So how do we appeal to that? We don't. They've left us. They are no longer a Republican government. They're no longer following the guarantees, the guarantee clause. They're no longer abiding by the Constitution of the United States. We have a responsibility. We have a right. We have a duty. It says so in the Declaration of Independence, to do what we have to do. Now, we've set up a reorganized California state in the same light as what they did in Virginia.
Right.
With West Virginia. And what we did is we appealed to the reorganized state. We got authorization from them, and we went on to Congress, and we've put in our appeal for statehood to Kevin McCarthy, Speaker of the House, which is the protocol to follow. And we sent delegates. We've already got 5 delegate representatives that we're prepared to bring back here in the next month or so to start the real serious nature of negotiations for statehood. And we will become a state very soon. It'll be very quick. The reason is California is suffering economically, as you're aware.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of other things. I think you're going to probably see the arrest of Gavin Newsom here shortly. I definitely think that's going to happen. And some other state officials for some of the things that they've gotten into. I'm not going to get into the details, but you just need to read the news. There's some big things happening. Certainly with Silicon Valley Bank, you've got stuff going on with the Hunter Biden situation. They've now moved the case, the Luis case with Hunter Biden, they've now moved it to the Central District of California. Okay, now what does that mean? That means that there's going to be some real investigation going on into the money laundering that has been pointed out to the whole world by New California. And what that money laundering has been, what has happened there, if you haven't heard already, we have what's called the Employment Development Department, that this, when the COVID virus hit, that money was just flowed right through this Employment Development Department of California and redistributed to anybody who wanted it, literally. That number is a staggering number. The number that the federal government agrees with the state of California in terms of the fraudulent loss is $180 billion. And Julie Hsu, who was our labor secretary in California, is now the labor secretary for Joe Biden.
How convenient.
And she's the one. How convenient, right? And she's the one who's who was before Congress twice. Congress rejected her because of a technicality. She's still there as the Secretary of Labor for the United States of America. Now, she's being investigated, finally, by the House. That's starting to kick off. There's some legislators out of California, Kevin Kiley, leading the charge. In fact, he was leading the charge against her here once he caught wind on it. But I want to be very clear. The person who really pointed out that she was doing fraudulent behavior was our own chief executive officer, Chris Street. And we have been watching the money in California like hawks. And he called up the person at the legislative analyst office in California the first day he detected fraud. And he said, you know, guys, I'm seeing that you guys are out $3 billion and it looks like blatant fraud. And they said, oh, no, Chris, you don't know what you're talking about. The next day, Chris calls up. I'm seeing there's now $7 billion. You guys need to check it out.
Mm.
So he calls back a little bit later and the guy says, Chris, you're right. There's $7 billion in fraud and we don't know what's going on.
Man.
That was New California that did that, by the way, through Chris Street. That's because we've been watching these things and watching these trends in the downhill spiral. But listen to this. This is huge national news. But the staggering number is that they agreed upon $180 billion has been lost. Chris Street puts his number at $300 billion. This is money that was gone for the first 15 months of the COVID thing.
Right.
My numbers for me and what my people have been telling me, this is Chris does separate stuff. I do separate stuff. Is about $850 billion, almost $1 trillion. Where did that money go? It all went to communist China. And we know the system. We know how it was worked. I'm not going to get into the weeds on that. That's an investigation. There's active investigations around that. But I'm just wanting to let your audience know that's how much money was laundered out of here. And Gavin Newsom's responsible for that. Gavin Newsom is responsible for the labs that have been popping up down in Reedley, California, the bioweapons labs that were sponsored by China.
Yes.
We are now finding out more about that. But Newsom has had his hands all in on that. And that's what they're going to investigate. That's why I think the arrest of Gavin Newsom is imminent.
Okay. And that makes, excuse me, and that makes sense. Wow. This is incredible information. As we near the close of the program, I want to ask you, what... Do you have faith in McCarthy, Kevin McCarthy? You mentioned, of course, in New California, you take it to the speaker, Kevin McCarthy, this and other things. I mean, you have faith in him or?
Absolutely not.
Thank you.
Come on. You know, You know, I was born at night. It wasn't last night.
So, I mean, what do you do if he just kind of blows you off, so to speak? I mean.
Oh, he's already doing that.
But, okay.
We haven't handled. Well, surprise, surprise. We haven't handled. We know what we're doing.
Okay.
Kevin doesn't apparently know what we're doing, but that's okay. We need to keep him in the dark. He needs to be a mushroom for a while. But, you know, there's things that are going to happen, and we will prevail. It's pretty obvious what's going to happen.
But. So, obviously, and this is why I have a lot of respect for Paul Preston, folks. I mean, this is one of many reasons. You anticipated this, obviously. I mean, the guy's useless. He's a globalist. He's in it for himself. You see how quickly he's impeached, or you know, Mayorkas.
And he's running. He's running away from a Mayorkas impeachment. Give me a break.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody wants him. Yeah, even exactly. The Democrats want him out.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Right. So yeah. Okay. So you know. So in other words, there is something there that they can. There's a remedy there that you can exercise without McCarthy.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. And obviously you don't have to say any more than that. So,
well, no, and there's a lot of people who know what it is, but we're not putting it out right now. We have, you know, there's a couple of things to consider here. Another thing, we're not out to ruin California. The way we split it is by population. So it's 20 million for California, 20 million for New California. It just so happens the 20 million we're looking at is the 20 million for all of the rural area of California, which is about 90% of the land mass. So you have the other 20 million living in the urbanized areas of Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Sacramento. But let me be very, very clear. We're not about hurting California. No, no, no. We're about helping California. And we're about making a strong California, just as much as we want to make a strong new California, because we think that having two strong Californias, new and regular California, strengthens this nation. And that's the most important thing to us, is how are we going to be strengthening the nation at this point in time, a nation that's desperately in need of strengthening. Our nation is falling apart, and our nation is falling apart because we haven't been true to the Constitution. And we bring that all back. That's one of the great things about the new state movement, is it shatters the totalitarians once they're presented with the facts and information. And once you use the Constitution to your benefit and listen to the Constitution, understand the Constitution, and that's where we come from. We want to see California being a strong state again. It's a very, very sick state right now. We think that we will reorganize, and we call this reorganized government, because we mean to reorganize the California government. This whole thing about them chasing businesses out and having these stupid corporations that are assigned to enforce laws and fees and penalties, like the California Air Resources Board. You know, all this stuff is bogus stuff based upon bogus science.
Yeah.
Once we start to straighten those things out, you're going to see California stand up and be a strong state and really contribute incredible things to this nation, as well as New California. And the New California's model that we have projected out there is dynamic. All the things that are going on right now in California with the schools and the federal oversight, you know, California, like a lot of states, their school policies are dictated by the federal government, which is not the way it's supposed to be. But, you know, they were clever. Back in 2009 and 10, they came up with what's called Race to the Top legislation, started by George Bush, picked up by the Obama administration within 1 year. And what it was, it turned out to be a grant program that in order to apply for the grant for money for your educational programs, billions of dollars at stake.
Mm-hmm.
You have to give up your 10th Amendment right to educate your children. You had to pass a bill in every state that wanted to apply just apply for it.
Right.
Doesn't mean you're going to get money. Before you apply, you have to pass that law that says you are giving up responsibility to educate your children to the federal government. And so people did. California did. Arnold Schwarzenegger did. I was telling people at the time, the county department, the State Department of Education, who were lobbying for this. I said, "You guys are a bunch. You just well, I said you're a bunch of idiots." I said, "You realize you're giving." That's not what I said, but I said, "You realize you're giving up the 10th Amendment right to for all parents to be able to be in charge of educating their children, and you're turning education over to the federal government." And so these people, oh no, we got to have the money, you know. That was the big thing. And so the night before, I'll never forget this, the night before in this studio, I get a call and they wanted to do a conference call, three consultants with the Department of Education. The night before, Schwarzenegger signed the bill. And they said, "Paul, we've heard you on the radio and you called us and we've talked and so on. But is it really true what you've been saying about the 10th Amendment? That we're giving it up?" And I said, "True. Yes." They couldn't believe it. I said, "You've given up the 10th Amendment right for local schools to be able to educate their children forever." And they're like, "Wow." So that's why we got Common Core. That's why we have critical race theory now.
Yep.
That's why you have an attorney general who feels he can come in and tell the public in a local school district board of education meeting to shut up or get arrested for felony federal charges.
Man, I'll tell you what, that explains or should explain so much to people, regardless of California or not. But that's in that case, it's all about the money. And
right.
Of course, the I would say the union.
It's about control.
Well. Yeah, it's
about control.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Fantastic. Folks, Paul Preston, Agenda the number 21, agenda21radio.news. In the remaining 2 minutes we have, brother, and by the way, I've been educated in this. Thank you so very, very much for your time. I know you're a busy man and you've got a lot of things to do. I so appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. But in the remaining couple of minutes here, any final words, message to the people of America, people listening to this, anything you want to say?
Yeah, don't give up on anything. You know, follow the Constitution. That's what we've been doing in the New California State Movement. And we've been underneath the radar. Pretty soon we're going to be out beyond the radar and they can't help but see what we're doing. But again, we're doing this for the best of what we feel as a nation. We know that if we rise up with a strong constitution and we form the state, that the rest of the nation's going to take suit, check it out and say, "Wait a minute, we got to go back to these concepts of the organic constitution." Many states like California, after the Civil War, got themselves into corporate constitutions and they adopted them, such as California's 1879 constitution. California is a progressive state. When you hear the word progressive, it means communist. Mm-hmm. They came in with progressives right after the Civil War, and they said, "Well, you know, we can't have this organic constitution of 1850. We have to do something different, something more modern, something more social." So they came in with it. And now this is what has happened under this communist 1879 state. They have passed, are you ready for this, 900 changes, over 900 changes for amendments to the Constitution already.
Yeah.
900. Now, how can you follow any kind of law with 900 changes to it? But, you know, each one of those changes makes it a constitutional right and responsibility for whatever the program or proposition was all about. Basically, what it is a big money giveaway. That's why California is faltering so badly economically. This year, this month, the next month, California runs really out of money as a state. This is that point of Margaret Thatcher where they say California has run out of other people's money.
That's yeah. I did hear that there's going to be some surprises with respect to what happens next with California, but then what? What happens then with no money?
With no money, there's going to be a problem, and we know how to solve the problem.
Yeah,
and we're here to solve that problem We know what we're doing. Other people are, you know, they're not engaged like we have been engaged. And right now, we know what's going to happen. We will become the 51st state of the union.
And there you go. And folks, you can read between the lines on that. Again, Paul Pressen, Agenda21Radio.News. Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate you. Keep up the great work. God bless you. Take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you very much.
All right. Folks, that'll do it. Have a great day. Please keep Paul in your prayers. Keep the whole initiative in your prayers. And if you get a chance, send Paul a thank you for appearing. God bless you.